Dick Gordon, this is The Connection. Years ago, across much of this country, whites lived here and blacks lived there, and often in very different conditions. Over the past half century, that has changed. But in some parts of the country, that change has not come as quickly as others. This hour, we're focusing on Moore County, North Carolina, where several poor black communities are fighting to receive the same basic services as their wealthier, whiter neighbors. Black residents settled in places like Jackson Hamlet and Midway back in the days of segregation, when they could only buy land outside town limits. Since then, residents have watched the march of affluence and expansion come ever closer. Now, many of their communities are surrounded by the large homes and fine golf courses. But the sewer pipes and the police and the fire and the trash removal services that have come to the new developments are still not available to the people who live in these historically segregated neighborhoods. So this hour, we're asking why. We'd like to hear from you. How do you explain this contrast of rich and poor and black and white in places like Moore County and elsewhere in the country? Some are calling this a straight-up case of discrimination. Others say it is a natural result of development. The root of the problem is economics, not race. What do you think? Is racial segregation a thing of the past in America today, or do you see it where you live? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And this hour, we are broadcasting live from the studios of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. So it is a pleasure to welcome here in these studios my first guest, Anita Earle. She is Director of Advocacy for the University of North Carolina Center for Civil Rights. Anita, it's nice to have you here in the studio.
Thank you.
And Maurice Holland Sr. is also with me. He is a resident of one of these communities, Midway. He's also a member of the Aberdeen Planning Board, a representative of the extraterritorial jurisdiction. And we'll stay away from some of those longer words, I hope, as we try to get a little closer to understanding what's going on. Maurice, it's good of you to come in as well.
Thank you.
I wonder if I can ask you to begin for us with something of a snapshot of what you see that really distinguishes Midway from the neighborhoods that now almost surround Midway. What do you think? What do you see in the contrast?
Well, I see a lot of things in terms of economics, in terms of services. The thing we are concerned about is failing septic tanks.
So houses. You don't have sewer pipes where you are?
Part of the community does as a result of a grant of the late 80s, which we anticipated to cover the entire community, but in actuality only serviced, I think, about 12 homes.
And what about trash? What happens? What do you do with your trash, for example?
Well, I have an old 76 Chevy van that I maintain just for that purpose, to take trash to the county dump. Though the trash truck passes in front of my house on Midway Road on Tuesdays and Thursdays of every week, it does not stop and pick up the trash. Police protection, I'm obligated to call the sheriff's department, though I'm only a half a mile from the police station and the firehouse. The fire trucks traditionally have gone up US 1 for a couple of miles, down Saunders Boulevard for about a mile and a half, and then came down Midway Road to come back to our community.
Was there when you say that, you know, at a certain point, Maurice, some sewer pipes were brought in, was there a point at which this kind of development was coming and then it stalled, or has it just been really, really slow?
Well, what happens is that our community has been there and we've been out of sight, out of mind. A good many people, until we started this last publicity drive, had no idea where Midway was. So the county has a collection land that runs through the swamp behind my house within 300 yards of every house in Midway. Blues Farm, Bethesda, on the other side, newer developments are tied into that land. We are not. And
so you pay county taxes, but you don't pay any town taxes, is that right?
No, we don't.
And get no town services as
no.
As a result of that. Anita, you've been studying this. Is there a simple explanation for why this continues to exist, why it's happening?
I don't think there's a simple explanation. It's a complicated situation that has developed over time, but it is certainly clear that it's a pattern more of rural towns, that bigger cities annex everyone.
Right.
And the most basic solution is simply to annex these communities, make them part of the town, and give them the services.
So why isn't it done?
Because the towns, first of all, see their obligation as to their own residents first.
The people who are already paying taxes.
Right. And there's simply not the political will to understand that their own development and their growth really depends on bringing these communities into their town as well.
Do you see it as a kind of discrimination?
It's certainly discriminatory. It's not putting everyone in the community on a level playing field.
Maurice, what do you think? Do you think it's discrimination?
Let me put it this way in simple terms. America is described as a melting pot. We are not in the pot. So we can't melt into the ingredients that are in the pot. We are kept out of the pot socially. We're kept out economically. So that, and because of the economic situation, we don't have the resources to develop as the rest of the country does.
Let's bring in one more voice, if we can. Steve Wyatt's been listening in on the phone. He is the county manager of Moore County. And, Steve, it's good of you to be with us on the program. Thanks for your time.
I appreciate the invitation.
I'm wondering what your thoughts are. You've listened to the kind of explanation that we're hearing here. Why does this situation continue the way it does?
Well, it's interesting, and I appreciate the discussion, and I think, you know, you're talking about some issues that I think are symptoms of larger problems, and I really think the issue, it goes back, and I'm no expert on the country, but in North Carolina, cities and counties are created by the state to be on the front line of health, safety, and welfare issues. Yet the laws that govern and empower cities and counties were written in the 1930s. I would say to you that North Carolina is not ready for the 21st century. We're sent in to do these, provide this first level of service to the citizens, and you know, we don't have the authority to do the things that need to do. You know, utilities have been something, and water and sewer utilities, that traditionally have been urban services provided by municipalities. Counties in North Carolina have been late comers to the utility issue. You know, you're familiar with the Jackson Hamlet situation. The county has water there, public water,
right,
which frankly puts most of the folks in Jackson Hamlet ahead of most of the people in Moore County. There's 80,
I need to try and keep this simple, if I can, Steve, just for my own understanding here. If the people in Midway say to the neighboring town of Aberdeen, you know, we'd like to be a part of Aberdeen, we will pay our taxes to be a part of Aberdeen, and in exchange for that, get the services,
right,
why hasn't that happened? I mean, they have made that request, right?
I don't know that they have. Has there been?
Yes, we did as a community, okay, probably about 15 to 18 months ago.
Okay. And what did they say at that point, Maurice?
That it was cost prohibitive, and that their responsibility was to the citizens of Aberdeen. So that's the catch-22. We are not the citizens of Aberdeen, even though if I walk out of my front yard one block away across the tracks, I'm in Aberdeen.
Steve, back to you.
It's an economic issue. It comes down to tax base. Aberdeen is run as a small business. And in, under North Carolina law, the main source of revenue for that town is property tax. Property tax goes to pay for the majority of the services. And I can't speak for the people in Aberdeen. But it sounds to me, based on the conversations I've had with Bill Zale, the town manager, who is very interested in this issue, and there is a lot of work, as I understand, and Maurice, you may want to talk to Bill about it.
I have, and he has, believe it or not, since the article in the Independent Weekly, I spoke to him, and he has assured me via email that he is gathering the pre-engineering data for the sewer and annexation, and is attempting to be prepared to present it to the town council in August.
Is it, Anita, in your research, is it a question of a tangle of laws between town, county, state, federal level that makes that slows this all down? Or is there a question of will here as well?
Ultimately, it's a question of will. If the towns want to make this happen, certainly it takes effort to get grants and funding, but they can get local legislation or otherwise get the law structured. We've certainly seen this problem beyond North Carolina in the rural South. Our state's laws allow this extraterritorial jurisdiction so that the residents in these areas have to go to the town to do anything with their property. The property is controlled by the town, but they have no vote in the town, and they're not citizens. That law certainly is problematic from our point of view.
And Steve, from your perspective as Moore County Manager, do you have an obligation to these people as taxpayers of the county to say, you know, we're going to do what we can to get you into the town so you have the same level of services?
Well, to get them into the town is an issue between those residents and the town. Again, you have to go back and see the mandates from the state to county government. 77% of our tax levy goes for the local education system. I mean, so that leaves you 23% to do the social services, the sheriff's department, the libraries, and those kind of things. Again, I go back to a more fundamental issue in this state. The system is not designed to empower local governments to do the job that needs to be done for our citizens.
Let me stop you right there, Steve, and just remind our listeners that this hour we're taking a look at the disparities that still continue to exist between neighborhoods and small towns in places like Moore County, North Carolina. We'll be talking about California a little later in the program. But are you hearing here a story about race or a story about economics? Our telephone number, as ever, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. And when you listen to this contrast of rich and poor and black and white in places like Moore County and elsewhere in the country, are you hearing a story of racial discrimination, development economics, or are the two now so wound up together that it's impossible to try and separate them? Steve Wyatt is with us. He's Moore County Manager. And Anita Earls, Director of Advocacy for the UNC Center for Civil Rights, is here with me in the studio, as is Maurice Holland Sr. He is a resident of one of these communities, Midway. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We're going to take our first call from Raleigh, and Sam is joining us on the line. Sam, thanks for calling.
Oh, thanks for having me. I appreciate being able to talk with you.
Yeah, tell me what you think.
Well, I'm seeing it as a concern of race. I work for a nonprofit affordable housing company based out of Raleigh, North Carolina, and we're getting ready to build a community with 32 affordable housing units in Southern Pines. And currently we're basically headed to Superior Court later this summer because the town is trying to stop us from building. Back in March 8th, the town amended their zoning ordinance to limit all new apartments throughout the town of Southern Pines to 10 units or less. And it's very clear to us at DHIC, and kind of it's on the record that specifically the town is motivated by racial concerns. Specifically, the town did not want a concentration of racial minorities, particularly blacks.
Why just by limiting the number of units in an apartment block is that seen as a question of discrimination or racism? Steve, Sam, how do you see that?
Well, I think what the town has done is they've looked at the apartment communities within their town, and they've recognized that a high percentage of the people living in their apartments are blacks and other minorities, and they're attributing the concentration in their schools of racial minorities based on the fact that they have apartments in their town.
Let me have Anita Earls jump in here. You know the story that Sam's talking about?
I'm somewhat familiar with it. I would just say that certainly trying to maintain existing minority neighborhoods is part of an effort to make sure that there's affordable housing in the area. But I also want to point out that in some parts of the country where we've studied this phenomenon, you do see that if a black neighborhood were annexed, it would significantly impact the racial balance within the town, so that a town that currently is not, say, a majority black town might become majority black if areas were annexed. I think there, in that circumstance, there's more of an indication that the current refusal to annex them also is based on race. But the thing about, and that's not true in Moore County, the towns that we're talking about. Well, what we haven't mentioned is that Moore County is the home of Pinehurst and the upcoming U.S. Open. And in fact, it's one of the richest counties in the state. We looked at their budget last year, and they have some $9 million in surplus. And we calculate that it would cost them $54,000 a year were they to get a long-term loan to put in sewer for Jackson Hamlet. So we don't see that the county has that kind of economic barrier to providing these services.
Maurice, in your perspective, I mean, the fact that we are talking about it at this time instead of 5 years ago, is it because we have seen this kind of growth in affluence, these larger communities getting bigger and in some case kind of almost wrapping around the smaller neighborhoods like Jackson Hamlet and Midway? Is that why the contrast has made it an issue today?
No, the contrast has always been there, and it has been even greater. For example, in Midway, there was a revitalization of homes, replacement of homes, because of shanties almost. But we're still set with one family who, because of zoning, has a house on a lot that does not meet the requirements of the county for a septic system. And the lady who lives there, Mrs. McDougal, is elderly and sickly now, and she can't live in a house, though the house is in good repair, because she doesn't have...
She has to go outside to go to the bathroom.
Well, the county, she had a porta-john sitting out in the front yard, but the county evidently made the remove that, and so they had to vacate the house. The other problem we have because of this is... And I guess it's a holdover from the 50s, 60s, 40s, whenever, is that financing in black neighborhoods, we have a problem getting bank rate financing. I had a cousin who wanted to build a house. She owned two houses in Fayetteville at the time. But she could not get financing to build the house that she wanted, though she has a master's degree, her husband's retired, she was working for the state. But she was able to build near one of the affluent neighborhoods with no problem.
I'm interested, Steve Wyatt, as you listen along to this. You said a couple of moments ago that you know, the laws and the these issues haven't really shifted into the 21st century. Is it because these municipal questions aren't really questions of what's right for the people, but really only what's right for the budget? Are people spending too much time looking at dollars and not enough time at what the people both in and outside the towns need?
Yeah, I think that it's even larger than that. I think North Carolina is stuck in a cycle where it plans only 2 years in advance. And that's, you know, a larger statewide issue than that, than what we're talking about here. I'd like to go to something that Anita said, because it's a little misleading. The county has some reserves. The county's reserves are equivalent to about 10% of the general fund. State law requires that we keep 8% in reserve, and the average county our size has about 17% for cash flow. But there's a bigger issue here at play is the fact that you need to come and see Moore County. Moore County is not a rich county. Moore County has pockets of extreme wealth, but pockets throughout of everything else. And that's one of the great problems we've got in North Carolina. The state deals with the counties as homogeneous counties. This county is extremely diverse. You have absolutely pockets of wealth and affluence that I've never seen before until I came here 2 years ago. But throughout the county, and I'm not talking about just these the Wayner Road, Monroetown, Jackson, Hamlet, Midway, and those are Lost City. You haven't mentioned Lost City. But you can go throughout the rural county, and there is a huge discrepancy. Because our public policy is not keeping up with the needs of North Carolina in the 21st century. It's a huge issue.
Let me go back to our callers here. I'm just wondering if our listeners tracking this are seeing this as a question of a tax system, which is inherently unfair. Those that pay get the services rather than other people who don't have those advantages also being taken into consideration. Or is there leftover discrimination, racial discrimination, as a part of this? 1-800-423-8255 is the number to join us. Next to Boston, and Dan's joining us on the phone from there. Hi, Dan. Sorry, David. My mistake. David, are you there?
Yes.
Thanks for calling. What do you think?
I was thinking that your last speaker had a good point. That the county's taking a homogeneous approach, as he said, and the issue is an issue of market forces, and racism sort of feeds upon that. We need to take an integrated approach, not to be punny. The problem
what do you
is
mean racism feeds on that kind of market approach, David? Explain what you're saying.
Well, what happens is with the market approach, it's the basis for our Western economic system, and it has inequality built into it because it's ruled by market forces, which are mindless, no eyes, no ears, and no mind, and it sort of runs over the poor. It serves the needs of the privileged at the expense of the poor, and racism just exacerbates this issue.
Is that, Anita, how you see it as well, that race ends up being a part of this that's first a class and economic issue?
When you say first, if you're talking historically, I think it did start out as racial discrimination and segregation in these areas. These are long-established communities. Families have been in Jackson Hamlet for over 100 years. But I also think that if we're going to move forward, rather than trying to sort out which is first or most important, you know, let's just talk about what hurdles we need to get over to include these people in these communities. And public policymakers do have a choice. Jonathan Wells, who's the annexation coordinator for the city of Charlotte, says that city leaders there avoid a bottom-line approach. He says, quote, "That's just not good public policy. Extending city services to those who can most afford them, I think you understand the kind of message you'd be sending."
And in addition to that, I would have to say that the caller from Boston is probably correct, because if you go back to the Old South, as it applies here, slavery existed for free labor, which is a base economic condition. And from that, unless you eliminate the inequalities that are started from that, then economics becomes the engine that drives discrimination. And they function like Siamese twins, where you see one, you see the other.
And so what you're saying is it's not good enough to say slavery is over, segregation is no longer public policy, we'll simply let the market figure out who lives where and who gets which services. You're saying there's a certain amount of, and Anita used the word, public policy that needs to be applied to try and balance things out?
It's base conditioning. What we teach our children in our homes, the attitudes, the perspectives, the fears, they travel. If that person is taught to be prejudiced and he becomes president, he will have a prejudiced administration. It's simply we have not taken the time to adjust to the reality of the 21st century, where neither white or black stands a chance of being a majority in America anymore.
1-800-423-8255 is the number to join this conversation. We're going next to Durham, and Ed's joining us on the line. Hello, Ed.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling.
Thanks. I grew up in a town just like Jackson Hamlet. I live in the county next over in Harnett County and lived in a place called Bun Level. And again, there's a town right nearby, Lillington, which could have annexed Bun Level or Shawtown or any of the other little hamlets that are around, but that completely has to do with racism. I don't think we can skirt around that. But the issue becomes, if you integrate these towns, one, Shawtown goes away and there's no city center or there's no community center left for those black people anymore. They're now integrated into Lillington, or if you're in you're integrated into Aberdeen. So you lose something there. So people have to make the decision, okay, if I integrate completely in, I become a part of Aberdeen or Lillington, do I then think everything is fine, I have my city services?
Are you saying that there are people, Ed, who don't want this kind of annexation, who like the separation as we are describing it on the program?
Not the separation, but if you look at places like where I came from, there used to be a high school there. There was a black high school, and all those towns had black high schools. And people had a sense of community and whatever. So So that would go away. So you run the risk of losing some of that. I'm not saying that's good or bad. I'm just saying that some people say, well, you know, this is where I grew up. This, they identify with that place. They don't want to not call it Jackson Hamlin anymore. Yeah. They still want to want that. The problem comes into what the county manager mentioned is in North Carolina, the state has so much control over what's a town, what's a city, how much money you have to have. So if Jackson Hamlin or Bun Level decides they want to be a town, they go petition the state to become a town and become incorporated, then they have to create their own government. The county's not going to be there to help them to get that started. And we already seen, and I think Anita probably knows about this, is that there's less and less, you know, community development block grant money to put in sewer and stuff like that.
Just stop you there, Ed, because there's a point that I want to hear from Steve Wyatt on, and that is this, you know, whether Steve, as county manager, you're getting a clear signal. Is it an absolute that the people living in these kind of unorganized neighborhoods all want to be a part of the neighboring towns? Or
it's my understanding, no, sir, that that's not the case. But I this is not, again, you know, this is also has anybody said this is a political issue? I think we've skirted around that a little bit, and it is every issue when you deal with government, there is some element of politics in there. I would also say I'd like to, on your next show for you, you need to invite the people from Southern Pines to respond to the question about the apartments. I think that would be fair. But in this case, you know, you have these political issues that come up over a period of, you know, of maybe 100 years or so, and they seek some resolution. But again, you know, it's not the county's role to demand from these folks, the towns that you go in there.
Right.
Now, are we using, am I personally using what influence I have based on the relationships I've got with Andy Wilkinson in Pinehurst, Bill Zell, Aberdeen, Reagan Parsons? Yes. We're talking about those things. We're talking about cooperative ventures, how we can do things. Utilities are very very complicated, and they are expensive. But is there a need? Yes. But I've got 40,000 people in this county that don't have a public water system. They don't have it for drinking. They don't have it for fire protection. The vast, vast majority of these folks do not have public sewer system. That is a public health issue that the county, again, is dealing with. And has the county done a good job in the last 20 years? Somebody could write a book. But now
let me see if I can stop you there for half a sec, Steve, and go to Pinehurst, because we've got a call from there. And Julia's joining us. Hi, Julia.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks. What are you thinking?
Well, I just wanted to point out, if people are trying to understand sort of the lay of the land in this area, I also live in the extraterritorial jurisdiction of Pinehurst. However, our street is all relatively affluent. These are all, you know, at least $500,000 homes on this street. We also don't enjoy city services, and we're under the zoning obligations of Pinehurst. The large difference between our situation and those of the families that are being described in Midway is that our developers purposely sought out this area because of the low land costs. I assume, because of the low land costs. And we built, you know, in the late 1990s, whereas these other families have been there since, as I understand it, the incorporation of the town and when segregation was rampant in the area. So
and this,
while it looks like economics, I have to think that there has to be more than that when we talk about curing this situation.
And that's another point worth taking into consideration, Maurice, that anything that is built right now, the developer makes sure that the sewer costs and the water costs are there and then just simply passes that along to the people who are buying, right?
Well, basically, zoning ordinances are designed that the developer is required to put in utilities, and that's passed on to the home buyer, so it's set up. One other issue I wanted to address from the caller from Harnett County is that it's up to the communities to maintain their heritage. In Aberdeen, we have community centers in each community. I went to an all-black school. It's now an elementary school. We have reunions that keep the spirit alive, one coming up 4th of July weekend.
But does that mean you don't want to be a part of Aberdeen?
No, we want to be a part of Aberdeen, and we have a community center in Midway. And we're presently trying to seek grants to upgrade it and provide more services for the community. So we have the space and adequate to put in playgrounds and so forth. So that's can be accomplished.
All right. Connection listeners, our telephone number, 1-800-423-8255. This hour, we're hearing the story of Moore County, North Carolina. And when we come back after the break, we'll hear how this is not just a story of North Carolina, but a story that is actually playing out in different areas with different histories right across the country. We'd like to have you in on this. Is there always a little bit of politics? Is there always a little bit of race? Or is it economics today? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection, and pretty well all across the country you'll see places where there are wide discrepancies between rich and poor, one part of a neighborhood, another part of a town or a village or a city. We have been focusing this hour on Moore County, North Carolina, where people who are kept out of the growing town are wondering what it's going to take to get the same level of services as their more affluent neighbors. The number for you to join our conversation is 1-800-423-8255. We're going to go to Providence, Rhode Island. Pam's joining us from there. Hello, Pam.
Hello.
Tell me what you think.
Well, I used to live in Palo Alto, California, in Santa Clara County, in the Bay Area.
Yeah.
And right across the Bayshore Freeway, less than a mile from where I lived, was East Palo Alto, California, which was not a part of Palo Alto. It was not even Santa Clara County. It was San Mateo County and was an unenfranchised, unincorporated area. It wasn't officially even a town, but it provided the labor force for much of Stanford University and the city of Palo Alto, which had a great deal for getting these people without having to provide any services for them. And that was very much not a rural situation. Your discussion of you know,
was
the
race involved in that, or was it simply economics, Pam?
It was, there was very much a racial element to it. East Palo Alto was virtually completely African American.
I mean, one of the questions here that comes up, and I've talked about it with people here in North Carolina, if we're talking about the people that helped build the, you know, neighboring golf courses, if we're talking about the people who are the cooks and the chambermaids and the hotels and all sorts of things, people who rely on the more developed parts of the area for their employment, do they have any reason to expect that they should get some measure of the same services because they're providing that kind of labor and support, Pam?
Well, of course they do. I think they have a right to expect, you know, that their children should be able to go to a school somewhat as suitable as, at least, as the children of the places where they're working. And that they can have fire protection. And this, again, was one of there was no city police protection. It was the county sheriff.
Right. You know, Pam, I'm glad you took me out to California.
And this was 20 years ago that I lived there, and I'm curious about how that's changed, if anyone knows.
Well, I tell you what I'm going to do, Pam. I'm going to keep the story here in California, but I'm going to go to a slightly different part of the state because Robert Rubin has been listening along to the conversation. He is a lawyer there. And Robert, I understand that you have a case not unlike what we're talking about here in Moore County in court where you're alleging discrimination involving Latino communities outside Modesto, California. Have I got that right?
Yes, indeed, it's very similar to what's going on in Moore County, and we have, in fact, joined forces with Maurice and Anita and are studying some common strategies that we can bring to bear on these problems.
See, one of the things that when you think about it in terms of the American South, you can automatically take this line of history back to slavery and the history of segregation to what some of these people on all sides of the issue are facing today. But in California, where the towns and the cities are much newer, what's the reason for it there?
Well, people don't think of segregation and racism perhaps as instinctively in California as they might in the Deep South, but it's unfortunately well and alive. But before I talk about that, I did want to hearken back to a point that came up as to whether or not this is, driven by market forces and costs. And I would say that even if you do focus, which we don't, because there's human beings and human dignity at stake here, but even if you focus only on costs, there are costs here in terms of a disenfranchised, uneducated, and sick population that if even local business cared about in terms of a healthy workforce, they would be providing these basic services. So even if analyzed in that more cold, market force mentality, I think that one would have to conclude that that basic services ought to be provided.
You're saying, Robert, that there is an initial cost to providing that same level of services, but over time, the neighborhood as a whole comes out ahead in not having to cope with, what, public health issues? What else are we talking about here?
Well, disenfranchisement. We haven't talked too much about, political voice, but that's certainly, a factor here as well. Here in California, we were approached a couple years ago by community leaders in Modesto, which is about an hour and a half outside of San Francisco, in the San Joaquin Valley, very fertile areas. And they complained about essentially two things: the lack of these basic municipal services that we've been talking about, but something else too, which was the lack of a political voice to do anything about it. Despite 25% of the population, Latinos have only had one city council member since 1911. We spent a full year investigating this issue, and what we learned, frankly, shocked us. We discovered racially segregated ghettos. We found pockets of impoverished, neglected Latino neighborhoods. We're talking about literal islands of unincorporated areas surrounded by wealth. And in terms of development, this can only be explained by purposeful neglect.
Well, and the fact, as you point out, that the people who are then in those neighborhoods aren't even don't have the opportunity to vote in or vote out politicians who might service them.
Amen.
First to Maurice and then to Anita.
Well, I had the pleasure of visiting
Robert
in Modesto and actually seeing the neighborhoods, No Man's Land and a few others. And my comment at that point was, hey, this is just like Moore County. Same one side of the street, you have sidewalks, fire hydrants, the works, trash pickup. The other side of the street, you got nothing.
Well, I just wanted to pick up on what Robert said about the human cost, because what we see in Moore County, in addition to the health effects, it certainly impacts the ability of the community to be maintained. Young people, they know the difference when they go home and they can shoot hoops on a out in the street, and the white kids have a beached off of enclosed beachfront area, less than half a mile away, where they can swim in the summer. And kids do internalize some of that, and it sends a message about what the community thinks of them and how they're valued.
1-800-423-8255, and we're going to take a call from East Lansing, Michigan. Coletta's joining us. Hi, Coletta.
Hi.
Tell me what you're thinking.
Well, what I'm thinking is that I certainly agree with the issues that have been presented in terms of North Carolina and California and the racial matters. However, I want to say that I've observed similar problems in Michigan, particularly northern Michigan, even without the racial implications. I've just completed a five-year grant from the U.S. Department of Agriculture under the Fund for Rural America, looking at economic development in rural counties. Two-thirds of Michigan actually is rural non-farm counties.
Give me a quick snapshot, Coletta.
What
did you discover then?
What you see here is this enormous disparity in wealth between the people who have lived there a long time and these new people who are settling out maybe in their summer homes and whatever. Yeah. And essentially using these places as retirement recreational areas, so that it's very difficult to separate, some of these racial issues from what's going on with the economic differentials that are taking place. And many of these counties are fundamentally, poor rural counties, and have great difficulty providing services, even if they want to. So I think that this phenomenon is much larger, is a much larger issue, and I predict it'll only get worse with the retirement.
Coletta, I'm really glad you called, because you remind us here that we're not just talking about North Carolina or California. When you talk about people retiring or moving into rural areas because they want that. I mean, we can talk about Colorado, we can talk about Vermont, we can talk about Maine. These pressures are building and happening in all parts of the country. Robert Rubin in California, you're legal director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights in San Francisco. Can you give me just a quick bit of overview here before I let you go. How do you deal with that? How do you get these different groups who are being pushed together, either differences in race or the huge differences in economics, and make it work? Because in every case, there seems to be a contrast here, a clash.
Well, it is a complex problem, and it's something that we use a full panoply of advocacy tools to address. One of them, frankly, is working with people elsewhere, like Anita and Maurice, to strategize on common issues and figure out how we can best deal with that. And we've met on a number of occasions, and we'll continue to discuss these strategies. What they involve are perhaps basic legislative changes in state law. In California, amazingly, there are no minimum standards by which a municipality has to provide services. That's one way to look at it. We obviously employ community organizing and public education and use of the media. And frankly, when you know, those tools are insufficient, we're forced to resort to litigation, and we are involved in a lawsuit now against the city of Modesto and the county of Stanislaus to basically raise these claims of discrimination. You really need to employ as many of these strategies as possible because it's a very complex problem. But the impact is so severe that we are in this for the long haul, and we are looking at it not just as a discrimination and delivery of municipal services case, but we have a second lawsuit challenging the voting system in Modesto.
Can I stop you there for half a second, sure. Robert? Actually, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take it back into the studio here, and thank you for both listening in and joining us on the program. Robert Rubin is co-lead counsel in the lawsuit in which residents in these largely Latino neighborhoods outside Modesto are arguing they have a right to representation and equal city services. And on that point, I'm just wondering, and I'm going to go right around the table of North Carolina guests here, if that's perhaps the way that some of these issues are going to be resolved here. Maurice, do you want to start? I mean, these guys are in court to try and settle this. Is that where you're headed?
Well, no. We're trying to resolve them through negotiated means. But I think until we are given a voice, it's key that we have the right to elect representatives who we feel will address the problems that we face. Because if we don't have a voice into the decision-making process, we will never be a problem to be discussed.
Does that make it a constitutional issue, Anita? Representation or taxation without representation? I mean,
yes, and certainly we have some legal theories of both equal protection and sort of representational theories. But what we ultimately hope, and we may end up in court, but what we ultimately hope is that we can create the political will to solve these problems.
Steve Wyatt, do you think that political will is there now? Do you think that if, as both Anita and Maurice are describing, the sort of current pressure on to try and get these matters addressed can bring people around a table so it doesn't have to end up in a courtroom?
Yeah, I think the most important thing is, one, is you got to define what the issues are. What I've heard here today is, it's all over the place.
Can I simplify it then? If I just say, all right, you've got these people who are living right next to a street that has all the municipal services, and they're saying, you know what, annex us. We'd like those same services, and we'll pay the taxes. If we just boil it right down to that as a basic, Steve, and say, can that be settled politically, you know, with goodwill, or is that going to end up in court? What would you say to that?
That's an issue of annexation, yes. But I want to say this very clearly. I prefer Mr. Rubin to stay in San Francisco because you want to slow this process down. Frankly, when Mr. Rubin shows up to the meeting, I'm out of it. Because what we're trying to do now is we're trying to work through the process with the players to get resolution and to solve some problems, despite the fact what we have to work with here is an archaic system. I think that we can solve these issues. There's going to be sewer in Jackson Hamlet. In my budget message this year, I said we need to find a solution for that. These are unique communities with unique problems, and there's going to have to be some unique solutions. As a community, we need to solve those problems. I don't think we need a lot of outside help.
Could I say something? The problem we have is that we don't have a significant voice or any power with the voice that we use.
Do you expect Steve Wyatt then to be your voice there?
This is the point. We still need to be incorporated so that we can demand on an equal footing. Right now, we are the child asking our parents to do what we want, and that's the way we view it.
Maurice, let's go meet with the mayor. It's Aberdeen Midway, right?
We've already done that.
Well,
We met with the mayor and the some of the whole council. We had a special meeting. This is when we petitioned the town to annex us. We have brought them out to Midway, showed them your sewer line and where it goes.
Yeah, which they may or may not be able to solve your problem.
I met with
Bill Zale 2 days ago. They've heard you loud and clear.
They've heard me, but I'm saying we also need that. In addition to these services, we need a voice, which means we need to be able to vote. That only comes with annexation.
You're correct.
Is that voice in part a sort of multi-pronged approach from you, using the media, using events like the coming U.S. Open and that sort of thing, or is it better done, you know, in those political back rooms where it's like, look, do this and we'll go away?
Our initial attempts at meeting with both Aberdeen town officials and Moore County commissioners yielded no results.
How long has that process been
going
on?
Over a year ago.
And
you did not meet with us a year ago. There was a meeting here a couple of months ago, and I've incorporated, and the issue was Jackson Hamlet. That's been incorporated into our plan of action for our fiscal year budget, which starts July the 1st. Read that budget message. We need to find solutions. We need to work together. We need to work with our partners in the municipalities.
Local government doesn't turn on a dime.
Give us time. Give us a chance.
It is something that you hear a lot of, Anita, that that all these processes are slow. They take a long time. Is that frustrating?
These communities have been working on this issue for years. Over 10 years in the case of Midway. And they're patient. They understand that.
Well, it's been a really interesting insight for us into that, and I want to take the last moment of the program to make sure that I thank all the guests for their time on this. Steve Wyatt, Moore County Manager, thank you for your time.
Yes, sir.
Anita Earls is Director of Advocacy for the UNC Center for Civil Rights. Thank you for coming into the studio.
Nice to have you here.
And Maurice Holland Sr. is a resident of Midway and a member of the Aberdeen Planning Board representing the extraterritorial jurisdiction. Maurice, thank you for your time.
Thank you for the invite.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.